Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the 2012 Retail Marketing Virtual Conference and Expo. I'm Melissa Campanelli, Editor-in-Chief of Retail Online Integration, and I'm pleased to welcome you to our opening keynote session, Cross-Channel Marketing Roundtable, sponsored by Xerox. Getting the attention of the increasingly distracted consumer is a challenge all e-tail and retail executives are facing today. They have to simultaneously and cohesively market their brands and merchandise in a variety of channels, catalogs, websites, social sites, mobile apps, and in some cases brick-and-mortar stores, as well as offer stellar customer service, the best shipping policies ever, and the lowest prices. Today's panel of key executives at leading cross-channel retail companies will be on hand today to discuss the key challenges cross-channel retail marketers are facing right now. We'll offer best practices around how to overcome these challenges and achieve success. Topics discussed will include understanding cross-channel attribution, the importance of cross-channel branding and customer service, customer acquisition and retention best practices, along with the key to customer loyalty, and social and mobile retailing trends. I also want to let you know that today is a Q&A panel, so we would love you to offer questions throughout the session as we're asking questions of our wonderful panelists. And speaking of our panelists, we have today three great cross-channel retailers: Jonathan L. Fleischman, the President and CEO of the Potpourri Group; Mike Massey, the Vice President of E-Commerce at the Potpourri Group; and Howard Weiner, the CEO of Sentiments.com. Before we get started, let me point out a few quick tips on how to make the most of today's webinar. First, if you have any, If you have any technical difficulties, troubleshoot by clicking on the help widget at the bottom of the console marked with the question mark, or let us know via the Q&A box. As I mentioned earlier, you can also use the Q&A box to submit your questions to today's panelists. We'll be addressing select questions throughout the hour, but you can send them in at any time. Please make sure you turn off any pop-up blockers on your computer so that you can use all the widgets and bells and whistles on this console. And speaking of bells and whistles, please click on the Tips for Attendees widget below to learn what all of the widgets on this console do and how you can customize your experience today. You can even tweet right from the console, and we encourage you to do that. Lastly, if you leave the session at any time or would like to view it again later, you can access the entire presentation from the auditorium in the Retail Marketing Virtual Show On Demand environment, which will be open for 3 months beginning on Monday, April 23rd. Without further ado, please welcome Jonathan L. Fleischman, the President and CEO of the Potpourri Group, who's going to give you a little bit of information about Potpourri Group. Take it away,
thanks,
John.
Thank you. I'm John Fleischman, and as Melissa noted, I'm President and CEO of Potpourri Group. We've been a long-time print channel marketer and also a long-time online marketer. We're sort of a 2 out of 3. We don't have any brick and mortar. Our business is built on a multi-brand strategy. We have 13 brands currently. We cut across multiple product categories, but our focus is on a singular demographic. We're really targeting the over 50 female customer, which is a very large demographic, also a very fast-growing demographic in the U.S. Our approach to the business has been consistent over really decades. We have what I would describe as a highly integrated and quantitative approach to the business, and I'd say that what we bring to our brands is a very low variable cost structure and expertise, and it enables these brands to go out into the marketplace and compete against other niche businesses. We've grown our company both organically and through acquisitions over the year with both special interest and lifestyle brands. You can see some of those on this slide. And we're also always seeking new opportunities to add to our portfolio. And I'll just close by noting our most recent acquisition. It's a good example because it's similar to really our track record over time was the Country Store, which had formerly been owned by Reader's Digest. We acquired and integrated that in the fall of 2010, and it's grown quite dramatically for us just in this short period. Thanks.
Great, thanks. And actually, Jonathan, can you just briefly let the listeners know what some of your your brands are, just in case they can't read the slide?
Oh, sure, absolutely. Maybe I'll just point out a few interesting ones. I mean, several of our brands are primarily in the apparel category. That would be North Style, Serengeti, and the Pyramid Collection, each positioned differently. Another sort of interesting brand in the mix, and our largest brand is Catalog Favorites, which really is a general offering, sort of the best of our portfolio. And then we have several what I call special interest brands like Back in the Saddle, which serves equestrians and horse lovers, and In the Company of Dogs, which speaks for itself. And then maybe, Stitchery, which is really dedicated to a needle crafter. And some of these businesses were entrepreneurially founded and owned. We acquired them, and as I mentioned earlier, we really bring them into a much more sophisticated and lower cost structure, and then they go back out, these brands, and compete typically against the 8,000 catalog brands that are out there that are mostly standalone, independently owned businesses.
Great. Excellent. Thank you so much. Before we get started on the Q&A, though, let's introduce Howard Weiner, and he's going to tell us a little bit about his Sentiments.com company.
Thanks, Melissa, and hello, everyone. My name is Howard Weiner. I'm the CEO of Sentiments.com. We've been online since 1998, which is about 75 internet years. We are an internet pure play, so selling designer fragrances, all your favorites from Dolce & Gabbana, Burberry, and on at huge discounts up to 80% off. And we offer a unique value proposition of offering free shipping with no minimum order. We're on the internet top 500. And we've been on that for quite many years, and we have a demographic of primarily a 60-40 split with women and men with noses. So that's who we're targeting, and we've been enjoying a great success by providing great customer service, fast shipping, and, again, low prices.
Are you expanding into other body parts, Howard?
No,
beyond noses?
That's about it for now, yeah.
and also, maybe you could just tell the listeners that you started out as a brick and mortar, correct? And then
we started as a store back in our stores were started back in the early 80s, and then back in like I said, 1998. Out of our garage, so to speak, we decided that it would be a nice, try this internet thing. Sounded kind of fun, and then we sort of progressed as the internet did, and as technology progressed, so did our company. We were able to adapt and continually grow as the years went by.
Okay, great, excellent. Just wanted to give the listeners a little bit of history there. So let's see. I think we'll get started. We have some questions that we've all discussed already, so we're gonna be asking those. But again, I encourage everyone listening to please ask questions as you go along, and because you have three great experts at your fingertips here. So the first question is something that I think is sort of a hot topic in the cross-channel retail space, and that is attribution. There's a variety of ways that people, attribution is thought of in a lot of different ways to people. In the catalog space, I feel like it's still kind of thought of as the matchback concept, whereas online, attributions refers to, the types of online marketing that you do and how you attribute your sales. But I guess I'm sure you both have different perspectives on it, given your business models. So, Jonathan, why don't we start with you? How do you approach attribution in your organization, or what does it mean to you?
I'm going to let Mike take this one, Melissa.
Okay, great.
Great. So in terms of attribution for Potpourri Group, being a company that's driven by the catalog and e-commerce being a support to the catalog as well as, attempting to generate incremental revenue, there's a lot of moving pieces there, and really it's intrinsic to our day-to-day business. The attribution ultimately impacts, you know, every area of our organization, and so there's a lot of resources that go into it. You know, in reality, we're very much data geeks. In simple terms, what we're trying to do is match every sale to the marketing campaign and the expense that created that sale, so then we can subsequently validate that against the P&L model and make sure we're generating, you know, the net profit that we need. We could easily spend 2 days on this, but really, you know, the key here is that we track 13 divisions separately. Each division has unique codes, and then within each division, every marketing source has a unique code attributed, you know, back to that unique marketing source. We don't aggregate our divisions, our channels, or our sources. Everything is, you know, treated as much as possible at a micro level. And then all that data will flow back through our enterprise system, and as well online, you know, we'll use supplemental data from our analytics. So we have two checkpoints, and I think that's an important point, is that anyone trying to do attribution, that you know, if you can, set up multiple checkpoints, because inevitably something will go wrong with one. And when you're trying to get back to $1 million of sales and you only have one source and that source is broken, then it's good to have a backup. So, you know, I would encourage everyone, you know, if they're listening that's going through this, is have a backup somewhere. You know, it doesn't have to be perfect, but it has to have something. You know, as John noted, we evaluate businesses constantly, and that's one thing that we tend to see when we evaluate businesses for potential purposes. This is where there's a breakdown. When we look at their sales and we say, okay, well, how did you generate those sales and how much money did you make off them? There's, you know, frequently a gap there. And I think that any business, no matter how large or small you are, you know, you can put more effort into this, and it's going to pay off in the end. You know, in terms of the challenges that we're facing right now, you know, what we're seeing is for our online business, marketing touches per order are increasing. So web shoppers frequently are hitting multiple touch points before they finally close that sale. They start with an email, they click through the email, they search on the search engine for your brand, then maybe they go to Amazon to see if your product's on Amazon. It's an endless cycle, and by the time they finally close the deal with us, you know, we might have spent money in four different places. And so the question is, you know, where do you give credit for that? And unfortunately, right now, there really isn't a good answer. You have, you know, first click or last click, which neither is really optimal. There are some technologies out there that are addressing this, but it's very much gray area. I think what you have to recognize is that it's really a moving target. You can't be 100% right. We're just trying to be less wrong. And you know, as long as we're using data and making data-driven decisions, we feel that we're on the right track.
Okay.
Maybe John would like to add to that.
Yeah, I think maybe that's a good overview, Mike. And I would just say that, you know, we're all experiencing the same things. And, you know, it's certainly not a perfect world. And for those of us, you know, like here at Potpourri, where we're mostly pretty anal and analytical, it's a frustrating world. But at the end of the day, our approach is one of conservatism. So when there's uncertainty about the incrementality or the allocation, we're always going to be conservative on the ad spend ratio side.
Hmm. Okay, great. Good points, everybody.
Melissa,
okay.
Maybe there's just, you know, one last point, because we are talking about direct mail and you mentioned matchbacks.
Yes.
Matchbacks, that is something that we're involved in. And, you know, the concept with a matchback is basically taking sales that you've generated online and then trying to match those back against our circulation and seeing where there's crossover. And we've done that, and we continue to do it. The point here is we've never really had an aha moment where we see some profound change in our strategy. You know, in general, there is crossover, but it's just a checkpoint. I think that you should do it, you know, at least, you know, throughout the year, you know, not weekly, not monthly, maybe quarterly, but it's just it is a good data point. The problem is there's a lot of voodoo there, and you need a lot of chickens and sharp knives to kind of get it right. So just be careful with it.
So do you still feel as though, I mean, is matchbacks a large part of your attribution strategy, or is it, you know?
Well, I think it's something that you do, and then once you get that first pass of data, it doesn't change a lot from there. So then it just becomes a touch point, you know, at periods throughout your, you know, financial, term, whether that's your fiscal year or your calendar year. I don't really think, unless you're changing your circulation model significantly, you know, from day to day, you're going to get different results every time you do it.
And it guides our attribution rules.
Right.
But
yeah.
Matchback doesn't sort of overtake the maintenance of all of our historical data.
Right.
Right? We don't reallocate it.
And you're looking at past. You're looking at something that's already happened. So it's just going to drive a future decision.
That's true. So it's almost like a research tool for you guys. So,
yeah, exactly.
Okay.
The validation, really.
Yeah. Okay. So, Howard, let's talk a little bit about your how you look at attribution. You obviously are more of a pure play. I mean, you do have other channels like mobile, but how do you look at attribution?
Well, we try to incorporate all the different facets of, you know, acquiring customers through the traditional forms, you know, paid search, SEO. We use, because we're dealing with a commodity that is price-driven, in comparison, shopping engines are pretty integral as far as, especially for us being a price leader as far as with the product that we sell or the brand names. So we have to incorporate those facets and understanding, you know, the customer and where they're going to be making those searches. So we want to make sure that, you know, we have we're available for them to find us. I mean, that's really the most important facet. I mean, we do dabble in the social media side, but more of a we're looking at like top down or vertical. Like we're using our site to drive them to our Facebook and Twitter pages, and I think people have been talking about using Facebook as a tool to generate customers to then drive them to the site. But you know what we find is that, you know, and what Facebook is a social tool, not necessarily a revenue generator. And uniquely because they can be your friend today and then tomorrow decide not to like you anymore. So you're spending these dollars to generate all these fans, but yet, you know, in the end, you're not probably going to get that ROI to sort of for it to make sense. So, you know, we generally focus on a SEO strategy and having our paid search sort of augment that. In this, you know, economic conditions out there, you know, you have to be very cognizant of what your spend is to drive that traffic and to make sure that, you know, you're getting that return on ad spend that you expect to drive profitability.
Great. I mean, do you have any sort of systems in check or in place for measuring? You know, like, for instance, you said that your organic drives your paid, or, you know, do you have systems in place about how you measure which channels bringing in the sales?
Well, yeah, our analytics will tell us certainly where they're coming from, you know, at any given point. You know, what we just want to be cognizant of is, you know, for us, the cost to acquire each customer. Being that we're a company of minimal margins, you know, we have to be very, you know, cost effective when it comes to acquiring those customers. So, you know, paid search is important, but, you know, we want to make sure that if they see our ad, you know, on the sponsored search, that we have an opportunity that we're showing a strong presence on the SEO side. That we try to get that customer to click on that link rather than our paid search, so, you know, we can acquire them at a lower cost. So, you know, we try to implement that strategy, and we also really want to focus on the long tails out there. you know, I think customers are becoming more savvy when it comes to doing their searches. You know, for instance, you know, rather than just searching for perfume, you know, they're really drilling down and being specific on what they're looking for. I mean, you can go outside of perfume and say they use this search for just, say, hard drives. Well, now they're searching for brands and sizes and everything. So, you know, we know that the customers are becoming more savvy that way, so we want to make sure that we're not forgetting about the long tail, because, you know, incrementally they're going to drive a lot of qualified traffic and their conversion rates are going to be a lot higher than dealing with the broad term. So, Now, once they come to the site and they shop around and they should happen to leave, you know, we do have a retargeting strategy out there as well. Ours is a little bit different. We use some companies out there that focus more on a personalization side. So rather than just seeing a static banner, we're going to provide a banner to them that's personal, that, you know, not only shows last click, but will also show other products that customers like themselves may be interested in. So, you know, just trying to touch on all points regarding how, you know, if they come in and if they exit, how we can, you know, get them to come back and complete the purchase.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot, Howard. I just wanted to remind the listeners that they can please ask questions. We have, obviously, a bunch of questions to get through, but we're going to probably move on. So if anyone has any attribution questions, please send them now. Let's see. Next, I think we're going to move into the next question, which is around branding. And I know that branding is a big part of your marketing strategy, John. So why don't you talk a little bit about that, about how you incorporate branding in all of your different channels.
Sure. I was just noting in listening to Howard that it will be interesting to sort of compare and contrast, because our business is really comprised of predominantly proprietary and exclusive merchandise, which is sold mostly private label under the brands of each of our catalog titles and websites. And so, you know, my perspective is all going to sort of come from that, you know. And I, you know, the first thing I would say is that, you know, for us anyway, that branding starts with the merchandise, and that the merchandise really defines the brand, because we don't have TV ads like Volkswagen might, and we don't have brick and mortar. So we have print catalog, and then we have all of our digital media. So, again, you know, for us, branding starts with the merchandise, and we, common theme here, you know, everything, you know, that we talk about as Potpourri Group is, it's really analytics driven, and so we're looking at customer preferences based on the profitability of what they buy, and so we're constantly adapting our category assortments and item assortments and price points, all driven off this merchandising data warehouse that we've developed internally over the last 12 years. We introduce something in the order of 7,000 new items a year across the platform, and they go live both in print and online simultaneously. So, you know, you can imagine that this is not something that we sort of do sitting around in the evening drinking beer, and it's got to be disciplined and analytical. So, again, product is really driving the bus. We do, at the end of the day, so we, you know, predominantly it's the print catalog that's determining what we have to offer. But then we complement that on sort of a rifle shot basis by adding complementary product online, which we handle mostly through dropship relationships. Because we already have about 45,000 SKUs in our warehouse, and we're not looking for ways to increase that. And, you know, I think the next point I'd make is that really from the onset of our developing websites, which, you know, I think goes all the way back to 96 before we even had transactional websites, that we've had a continuity between our print and electronic marketing. So there's a clear structure in place that goes from print to the websites to our email campaigns, social media, and soon to be our mobile optimized sites. And there's a highly structured collaboration. I don't mean to sort of take all the fun out of it, but it's a very formal process that goes. It begins with the brand merchant and the VP of merchandising, and includes art direction, creative director, copywriter, and then on Mike's side, director of internet merchandising and the web creative team. And it is far from a situation where one hand doesn't know what the other's doing. There's just no room for that in our business. We have, five seasons a year. We're changing 25% of the merchandise in each of these 13 brands, and you really need a structure to avoid things going very wrong. As part of this continuity, we quite dramatically leverage that investment in creative photography and copy, because the copy, in addition to the photography, which is really just a representation of the merchandise, which is where I started, but the photography and the copy really, again, point to and define the brand. And so we maintain a continuity all the way through the channels and really leverage the value of that digital asset, if you will.
Great, excellent. Before we move on to getting Howard's perspective on this, we do have some questions that I guess I missed, so I'm very sorry about that, that kind of go back to the attribution stuff. So do you mind if we just kind of switch gears for a quick second? This one, I believe, I think should be directed to John. How do you use attribution to decide catalog mail dates? Or perhaps Mike would answer that.
There's the way you would, if you were going to try to tie the two things together, then what I would say is the attribution determines how we track the historical results of the mailings, which are done by offer. An offer would be the spring buyers or the spring prospects, for example, and the attribution is really what's loading that history. And the history is determining what we can and would mail going forward. So it's a pretty direct relationship.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. This kind of, I believe, could be to Mike or Howard. How important is retargeting to your marketing strategy, and how does the ROI compare to search?
This is Mike. In terms of retargeting, out of our 13 divisions right now, we're doing it with four or five. I don't remember the exact number, but we tried it with all 13. So the answer there is it works for some and it doesn't work for others. So it's really, it's very specific to the type of customer, what they're shopping for, and then how you're retargeting them. I think Howard mentioned, just some kind of a generic type of branding ad served to them at some subsequent point is certainly going to be less effective than showing them the exact item that they just, abandoned on your site. Being more specific is going to generate better results, but the bottom line is you have to test it. Not all of it is incremental, and that's really the key, is you have to try to figure out how many of those sales you would have gotten anyway, and how many of them are truly incremental. And that's where it gets tricky, and that only comes from testing.
It's basically, I'd say, just part of the overall strategy, to, again, capture that customer. I mean, not only retargeting, which we do get a pretty good return on our investment for that, and conversion rates are double digits, so it does work, And then I think we just didn't touch on shopping cart abandonment. and using that strategy as well. So, you know, as the customer progresses through the checkout process, if they should jump off, you know, we're gonna tap them on the shoulder and sort of remind them that they need to make a purchase. And we do A/B testing between just reminding them versus in some cases we'll you know, a couple steps down the road, we'll incentivize them to come back with a coupon of some sort. And, you know, with all of those different strategies in place, you know, you're going to increase your opportunity to convert that customer rather than, you know, not having it. So it's I think it's good to have. And, of course, you'll test it to see that if it works for you. For us, integrating retargeting aspect and then shopping cart abandonment for us works very well. So,
okay. And actually, one of the listeners just had it. Sometimes I forget the variety of folks on the calls here, but can you, one of you guys, define what retargeting is?
Yeah. I mean, retargeting is, there's different methods involved, and I suppose it's a little bit broader, but in a typical sense right now, what we're talking about is, someone comes to your website, they browse around, they shop products, and then they leave the website, and at some point in time, they're on a search engine or they're on some other property, and they receive a banner ad for the item or your brand that basically tries to get them back to your site. There's different technologies and different vendors that do this, and they do it in different ways, but, you know, basically they're tracking these users through their own networks and then integrating with your system. So there's platform integration that has to be done. It doesn't just magically happen. So you have to have the ability to, to put page tags on your website. So there is a little bit of work involved, but essentially that's what it is. And then you also have retargeting, such as Howard mentioned, which might be you as the seller is triggering a retarget based on an abandoned session through an email or something like that. And again, that comes from having a system that's collecting emails, or you run email campaigns, and so that you can track that user's actions. So there's a lot of stuff that happens kind of under the covers here.
Right. That's true. And before we move on to the next set of questions here, I just have one more in regards to the opening question, and that is, Howard, maybe you can take this one. Can you talk about the correlation of search terms, the correlation between search terms and purchases? Like, is there any way that it can be measured that if somebody purchases some type of toothpaste, that it will result in this, you know, some type of lipstick or something, just as an example?
You mean sort of like going into your grocery store, going for some milk and walking out with other products? I mean, you're dealing with some type of. It depends on the retailer specifically. I mean, for fragrances, customers are pretty brand specific. I guess we're going to move into the topic of branding, or my aspect of it. So, customers walking through Bloomingdale's, they stop by the fragrance counter, they see a bottle, they're trying their fragrances, and then, the Best Buy scenario happens. They sort of leave, they go home, or they look online to see if they can find the best price on their fragrances. So for us, customers are pretty loyal to their products or brands, and they're going to sort of stay within that. For us, when we do on our site, when we have cross sales or upsells, it's the conversion is okay. It's not great. So, specifically, if they're going in for an obsession by Calvin Klein, that's what they're going to buy. That's what they wear. They've worn that for 20 years, and they're going to leave. So, for us, it's really hard for us to determine, why they're buying those other products. Is there a loved one in their home that says, "Oh, by the way, buy that for me"? Do they have to buy a gift for someone as well? So it's really hard for us to determine the correlation between what they're looking for, what they leave with, other than what they wanted to purchase in the beginning.
Right. Okay. So let's move forward now, talking about branding a little bit more. Howard, how do you look at branding?
Well, you know, we're dealing with designer fragrances, so a lot of the work or the heavy lifting is being done by the manufacturers. You know, you see an ad in GQ, you see an ad in Vogue for a particular fragrance, you scratch and sniff it, and then the search begins for that customer online. And then we touched upon that, you know, through attribute, you know, where we're going to acquire those customers with attribution and such. So, you know, what we need to be able to provide to our customers is that, you know, that UVP, the unique value proposition, what are we going to be offering them versus all the other retailers in the same space. You know, we have to be consistent with our message about great prices, free shipping, no minimum, availability of customer service. I think that's the most important thing because, you know, as an internet retailer, you need to be able to provide that buyer assurance that they're buying from a real site, not a fake site. As you know, there's always that concern, and that that we're going to provide that service to them. From the first click to the delivery, you know, we always say that the sale will never ends when you have that customer. They're your customer, and how you treat them along the way is what's going to sort of differentiate you from the other vendors out there. So, you know, that's sort of how we brand ourselves as a low price mm-hmm. leader with great service and fast shipping. I know it's easy to say, but it's the intricacies that deal with that from, you know, when the customer makes a phone, when they call into our call center, from post-transactional emails to how we communicate them through the whole transaction is what really sort of makes the difference.
Great. Okay. Let's move on. Jonathan or Mike, do you have anything to add to the whole branding concept or after?
Yeah, this is Mike. I would just, you know, add there that the challenges coming up with branding, you know, for most e-commerce and multi-channel retailers is mobile. You know, we've all addressed going from print to email to, you know, web, but now we have to go print to email to mobile. And as John mentioned, you know, our branding is driven from our merchandise. And so now we're going to take a beautiful high-res, you know, photo that we've taken, and we're going to shrink it down to the size of a postage stamp and hope it looks good. And so, you know, that's really going to be the next level of branding, especially for businesses that are, you know, merchandise focused, is how do you translate that to a mobile device? I think with tablets, it's, you know, it's less of a problem, but certainly with smartphones, you know, that's a real issue to incentivize someone to look through clothing, you know, on a device like that and really get the true feeling of what they're buying. So, you know, that's a big challenge. You know, the other thing I would add to the branding is that just as an aside, you know, several years ago, we spent a lot of time internally here collaborating between the e-commerce group and our creative, you know, our print production group to create style guides. And that collaboration, you know, set a template so that, you know, now there's no real confusion about branding between online and offline. Everybody knows what the template is. And this might sound basic, but a lot of companies don't do this. And so then you get this, you know, that's where you get that disconnect online and with your catalog. And, you know, ultimately what happens there is the customer is the casualty. So you just have to draw a line in the sand and say, you know, the channel that has the most consumer influence has to set the tone.
That's great. That's a good point. And I can see that moving, being such as the case going forward. Okay, let me move on to questions. Let me just make sure that we don't have any other questions around branding. Does it look like it? So let's move to the next question, which is obviously a popular topic, and some of the questions that we're already getting are on this. What are some of your key marketing tools for success? So, Howard, why don't you take that first?
Well, currently there's two facets.
You already talked about it, yeah.
Yeah, but for us, when a customer is on our site, you know, we want to be able to personalize the experience So, you know, I sort of touched upon with, you know, cross-sells and upsells, and when they're looking for particular brands and they make that purchase, you know, we're going to, you know, provide them other options for them to make a purchase through the process. Then after that, you know, we want to be able to communicate to our customers on a different level through marketing email. So, you know, rather than sending them a sort of a blind email with product offerings of stuff that we're out, you know, overstocked on or whatnot, you know, those types of emails traditionally throughout, you know, throughout the retail space, I mean, I experience it myself. When I get an email from buy.com, they're always trying to sell me a flash drive. Well, I don't have any interest in flash drives. Why do you keep sending me that email? You know, and with that philosophy, you're not going to get really good conversions. So for us, on the personalization side, when we send emails to these customers, we know who they are as far as what they've purchased. We've seen from their click patterns what they may be interested in. So, you know, we create these personas of each customer. So, you know, say hypothetically I send out, you know, in a week 100,000 emails. Well, it's not one email to 100,000 people. It's 100,000 individually crafted emails to each customer based on what they've purchased, what they were interested in. You know, there's different components in there between retargeting, new product offerings. If they've made a purchase and we have a price drop, they're going to be notified. So, effectively, by doing that, we get great returns on these emails, and these customers are more prone to open these emails because of that personal aspect. It's not as noisy because it resonates with that customer. So, you know, that's sort of what's been very, very successful for us is that personalization side. And as I also mentioned in the retargeting aspect, you know, we use personalization when those customers see those banner ads. So by incorporating that, we've seen better than average return than traditional emails that are sent out. And then recently, as early as November, we started a new loyalty program. We call it the Sentry Club, you know, with the play on scent, you know, the play on words there. And rather than just using traditional methods of rewarding customers for making purchases, we're trying to leverage the social side of a customer to drive traffic. So the premise is, you know, everybody has a friend, 500 friends, say, and, you know, those friends will have similar demographics, similar lifestyle experiences. So your customers now become your brand advocates, and by providing them an opportunity to get rewarded for those actions can drive qualified traffic to your site. So, for example, you know, we give a $10 off coupon for anything of $60 or more when you hit the 500-point tier. So if you've made a purchase and you're at 400 points, through just some simple actions of referring a friend or two, you know, tweeting about us, posting something on Facebook, it drives the action quicker than simply waiting for that customer to make that purchase maybe 5 or 6 months down the road. And again, by leveraging them, they can now spread the word far, you know, the word of mouth, which is probably the most effective form of advertising, drives that traffic, and we're seeing tremendous returns on our investment regarding that program. So those are our two key elements for us as going forward to find new ways of getting customers to come to our site.
And you want to talk at all, Howard, about how you integrate that with your Facebook page or how Sentry Club, you know, how you integrate it on social media?
Well, like it's just this last slide that you see, that is that's our Facebook page, and essentially sort of reemphasizes how you generate points. And then on the right hand side, you see our leaderboard. So we're sort of gamifying it and showing customers where they are in the process, and you know, it's like the whole it comes everything comes full circle. So, you know, you have the gamification part, you have the social part, and then you have the simple actions of being rewarded for making purchases. And, you know, if I want to just throw out a number, we're seeing that the customers that are engaged in the program spend about 15% more. Our average order value is about 50% more than customers that are, or actually I say that are not yet enrolled in the program. So we're seeing, as I mentioned, a really good return on what was on the program.
Okay, great. So let's, Mike and Jonathan, want to talk a little bit about marketing tools for Potpourri?
Yeah, maybe I'll take a little bit of a different tack, sort of from 30,000 feet, more at a strategic or structural level. And, you know, I think a lot of what I say probably really applies to almost anything that you're selling, whether and through any channel, you know, whether it's print, retail, you know, or online. So I have about half a dozen, you know, takeaways that, you know, I think, you know, sort of they define how we approach things, again, from a higher level, and they really have led to our, you know, story of growth and profitability over, you know, 20-plus years. So I think, you know, the first comment I'd make is to make it easy for the customer. So whether that be, you know, phone, mail, internet, whatever, it's not as easy as it looks, and it's easily demonstrated, you know, for any of us to take a credit card out and shop online or even call a retailer. Not everybody has this down. And so, you know, I would say that, you know, on the online side, that site functionality is really our first goal. And the way I describe it is it's really like the physician's oath, you know, it's do no harm. So you got to start there. Site needs to be, and this, not everybody can claim this, reliable, fast, navigable. The necessary purchase information has to be easily accessible. You have to have accurate in-stock information. It has to be easy to check out. It has to be easy to come back and check order status. And, you know, in our business with tens of thousands of SKUs and thousands of multi-level styled items and colors and sizes and extra large sizes, all of that, and 25% of our merchandise changing 4 to 5 times a year and then upsell offers on the back end, it's really not a no-brainer. And so, to me, that's sort of the starting point. And then in terms of, you know, how we determine where and how to spend our marketing dollars, it's really critical that you understand all your variable costs. And when I say variable costs, I don't just mean the marketing cost, but all of your fulfillment, all of your operating costs, because the way we drive our business is through understanding our variable cost structure, understanding the short-term value of an acquired customer or an existing customer, and that really drives for every initiative or channel, what we can spend to get an incremental sale and make a profit. So, you know, when you take that view, part of our marketing best practices is to have the lowest possible outbound freight cost that we can have, or have the lowest possible fulfillment cost, labor cost in our warehouse. I think another important one that we've already touched on earlier is, you know, have the highest realistic levels of accurate attribution that you can through direct coding, and then be realistic and estimate the true incrementality of all of your marketing activities, even when a perfect answer isn't available. I know we touched on this earlier, but that's, you know, often, you know, perfection is, you know, the enemy of, you know, good and excellent. So you have to make compromises and move forward, but to capture as most the most accurate data that you can as you go. As I think both Mike and Howard mentioned earlier, you really need to acknowledge and account for the spending from multiple initiatives very often that went into gaining a sale. And that's becoming more and more complicated, obviously, for all of us. And as I just mentioned a minute ago, I think that one thing that we do well and often is to understand the future value of a customer. We literally know the difference between the value of a customer. Each brand has a unique value, and then within the brands, each brand has a different value depending on what time of year we acquire the customer. So in a business that has seasonality, where you're doing a lot of fourth quarter gift giving business, a customer acquired in the spring is worth more than a customer acquired in holiday. So because in the first 6 months, you're going to get a holiday season from the customer, and also often the customer you acquire in the holiday season is going to be a holiday or gift shopping customer, so they're not going to have as much value to you in the off seasons. So I would say that short-term variable, profit or value of a customer is something that when we look at acquisitions is often sorely lacking. And that's what you really need to understand how much you can spend. So if you don't know that, you don't know what you can spend. Our business has always been, there's no hard and fast rule here, but our business has always been driven on maximizing our variable profit. And so all of these things I've just mentioned really lead to facilitating that, and we never chase revenue. We've just never done it. And so during some of those early years of e-commerce, we were certainly in the mix, but, we never blew our brains out. And we've always been willing to maybe leave some growth behind on the top line to maximize our short-term profitability. And it's done us in good stead. And then maybe the last thing I would say again, this comes not just from how we run our shop, but also because we look at many, many businesses in the marketplace, testing promotional offers often and being certain that you attribute all of the associated costs appropriately. It's sort of like a little math class here, and often we don't see this used correctly. If you have 50% contribution to your marketing costs after your cost of goods and fulfillment costs, and then let's say you run a free shipping promotion and you're giving up $12.50 that would have been the average shipping, you actually need then a $25 lift in demand per order just to break even. And if your average order is, let's say it's a $100 average order, that would mean that to make that free shipping offer just to break even, you need a 25% lift. And we often see the discipline lacking when we look at how people evaluate their promotions. And then the other aspect of it is, there's no rest for the weary. You've got to keep backtesting these promotions because they fatigue. So that's my two cents on marketing best practices.
Yeah, that's excellent. Those are great points. It's a good... it's good to sort of take a step back, instead of just thinking about, tactical issues when it comes to marketing. But speaking of more tactical questions, a couple of folks have asked some questions around these topics. One, I think either Howard or maybe, maybe Mike could answer it, but anyone use affiliate marketing? We haven't really touched on that at all. Is that something that is on your radar, or have you tried it and happy with it or not happy with it?
Yeah, this is Mike. I mean, affiliate marketing, as everybody knows, it's been around forever. It's kind of the dinosaur of e-commerce. And maybe this is a bit of a jaded perspective on this, but, our view of affiliate marketing is that, and this has come from years of experience, for the most part, the incremental revenue you're getting from that is questionable. And if you really dig into your affiliate marketing program, you're going to find that probably most of your sales are being generated from affiliates that are poaching on your brand. So someone's searching for the name of your business, and you're the number one link and maybe number two link, and then you have these other sites underneath that might be affiliates. And you have to look at it, and from our perspective, we look at it as, well, I'd rather have them there than my competitor. So then it becomes, well, what am I really willing to pay them for that? And that's the real key here, and the tip that I would probably give to anyone listening who's doing affiliates, and if you're in a affiliate listening, you're probably kind of going to be pissed off. But if you're a retailer, you can probably cut your affiliate commission in half today and retain 99% of the sales. Because if you look at it from a perspective of that affiliate that has a link, if you're paying me 10% today, but tomorrow you tell me you're going to pay me 5%, I'm not going to remove that link, you know, because I've been getting that 10% for free for so long. I'm not going to be happy about it, but I'm not going to go out of my way to drop you. And so, I mean, that's what I would say. On the other hand, there are a few affiliates that will generate incremental sales, and so you have to cull them out and develop a separate relationship with them. But looking at it from just a holistic view of the whole industry, you know, most retailers out there, you can cut your commission and retain your sales.
Great. I guess we only have about 5 minutes left, so I think I'm going to move to the last slide. I'm going to sort of push through here, I think we should just touch on best practices around operations and fulfillment. So I know we only have about 4 or 5 minutes left, so maybe John and Howard, you could each just kind of, or Howard, maybe you could start, you know, if you have any best practices around, you know, how you handle fulfillment. I know.
Well, yeah, I mean, we do ours in-house. It's important for us and, you know, for our call center staff to have local knowledge of our product. We took a portion of our business for a short period of time of an experience to try to outsource and use a third party to do it. And the mantra, don't give up your key, your core competency came into play because they did not do a really good job of being able to provide the correct item when you ship out that product. So if you can, keep it in-house. You know your product better than anyone. Handing it off, and I'm sorry if there's any fulfillment companies out there, but you know, keep it to yourself, and that way you can, you know, handle all the different aspects from pick, pack, and ship, you know, and do it in a way that, again, that's another facet of your marketing program and how the customer gets that product is pretty important. You know, how we communicate with them, you know, how we ship the product. I mean, the fact that we offer free shipping, no minimum, you know, we have to offer a product to them that's certainly low cost to us but can get to the customer in a timely fashion. You know, we've been able to negotiate some really incredibly low rates on packages under a pound, and because of that, we can, you know, keep our margins at a pretty good clip and not sort of paying Brown all the money to move that package. So, you know, making sure, and again, because we're a slim margin company, we have to be lean and mean. And of course, we have to do it in an efficient manner because, you know, if you order anything before 2 o'clock today, it's going out the door. So you better have processes in place that can facilitate that order. I mean, knowing that we ship our stuff out, there's nothing that annoys me more that when you place an order on a Monday, so to speak, I don't get a shipment confirmation until Wednesday. I just don't understand how companies take so long to ship out products. So, you know, you need to make sure that you have those processes in place to be fast and efficient because, again, when that sales takes place, if you're known to be a slow shipper, then they'll just find another company that can ship out the product fast. Because if there's anything that internet customer wants it now, and you better be able to provide that shipping. Now, being that we don't offer Brown UPS as the first choice, you know, we communicate to that customer that because it's free shipping, it may take 24 to 48 hours longer, or you know, 1 to 2 days longer. But from the feedback that we're getting, when we give the options for those customers to, you know, for $3 more to go UPS, they'll still opt for the free shipping. So that term free really resonates with the customer. So, you know, that's sort of a pretty important part as far as how we get the packages out the door.
Okay. I wish I had some time to get a rebuttal from John, but do you agree in-house or outsourcing operations and fulfillment?
You're asking me, Melissa?
Yeah, I'm sorry, John, yeah.
Okay, I'll be very brief because I know you're out of time. So I certainly agree with Howard that, you know, that fulfillment operations, front and back end, are really, it's a touch point with the customer. And so we do mostly fulfill both, you know, call center operations and back end warehouse in-house. But I will say that we do outsource strategically so that by intent, we probably handle about 85 to 90% of our call volume internally, but we cut off the peaks and we route those calls intentionally to a third-party partner. And even though that cost is about double our in-house cost, it's still a lot cheaper than our staffing for those quick up and down peaks that marketing events cause.
Mm-hmm.
And then similarly on the back end, on the fulfillment side, we have a toy brand that is, as you can imagine, is tremendously seasonal, and we have a very nice symbiotic relationship with a third party that has a counter-seasonal business. And so for many years, they've handled the fulfillment, which is predominantly a Q4 task for this toy business, and we avoid having to add 150 people just for those 7 busy weeks.
Yep. I've heard that sounds like a great plan. Okay, well, I think we're going to have to end our discussion. Thank you, all three of you. Thank you so much for your great insight. I'm sure our listeners learned a lot, have some great things to take back to put into their arsenal of retail marketing best practices. So on behalf of Retail Online Integration Magazine and Xerox, our sponsor, I want to thank you all for attending this session. Let me remind you that if you're interested in discussing anything that you heard, visit the networking lounge to chat live with other session attendees about it. And you can also visit the info booth to fill out our share survey to let us know about your experience today. That would be very grateful if you could do that. Please also check out the agenda for the rest of the day. We have several wonderful sessions lined up and encourage you to view as many as you can. And if you don't watch them live, add them to your briefcase and view them at your convenience in the on-demand environment. Have a great day, everybody.